I'd like to remind all participants this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you very much, Kelly. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is a BC members call taking place on the 2nd of May 2013. On the call today, we have Jimson Olufoui, Zahid Jamil, Elisa Cooper, Janet O'Callaghan, Angie Graves, Ron Andrus, Emmett O'Keefe, Philip Corwin, Steve Del Bianco, Chris Chaplow, Richard Friedman, Angeli Hansen, and we have apologies from John Berard and Stefan Van Gelder. I would like to remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you, Steve.
Thanks, Benedetta. Appreciate the turnout. We'll get this done in 1 hour. Our purpose today is to figure out what the BC wants to say about the proposed final Registrar Accreditation Agreement, or RAA. For those of you in Adobe, Benedetta has posted my notes or outline up there. And for those not on Adobe, the email sent out about 45 minutes ago has the same outline with links to the public comment page and the RAA and any particular specification. I was talking to Anjali and Elisa Cooper about a potential approach today because we ought to be able to get this done in an hour. And we thought a three-part outline would be the easiest, the first part being privacy and proxy specs, second is who is, and third is this new registrant rights enforcement. If we have time, we can take on other topics as well. Anjali, as rapporteur volunteer, had already developed the beginnings of a draft, and that was, of course, before they published a brand-new RAA, proposed final one. And these comments won't be due until the 13th of May, so we've got a little bit of time to get it together. But let's see if we can come to closure on it today. Any questions before we start? Great. So the first item up is privacy and proxy specification, and I'm glad we have Elisa on the line. I know you're pretty familiar with that as well. So is Susan Kawaguchi, who I think will provide some input even if she doesn't make the call. This is a two-page specification on the way that privacy and proxy registrations have to be managed, but it's really supposed to be temporary, right, because they're supposed to be a community-driven process to define an accreditation process for privacy and proxy providers. But until that gets done, this specification will live in here temporarily. Alicia, I know that you're driving right now, but if you're in a position where you can weigh in, please just jump in. But I think what we wanted to talk about.
I am at the office.
Okay. Oh, great. So what I put in here is one item on the privacy proxy spec, which is that there's no service level in here for how quickly or in what way the privacy proxy provider has to relay the communications to the protected registrant, and then presented with evidence of actionable harm, how they have to reveal the data to the complainant. So any of you who are online, you can click on that hyperlink right there, and it'll take you to that two-page privacy spec. So what we're focusing on there is 2.43, which is relay, and 2.45, which is reveal. So why don't we take a cue? I'd love to start with you, Elisa, about what you think the BC ought to ask for here.
Well, I think that it's great. First of all, I mean, I would applaud the fact that they're addressing this and laying down some guidelines that registrars should post on their websites what their policies and procedures are. But basically, that's all that this new agreement is requiring, is that the registrars describe what their policies and procedures are, what the procedure for reveal is, what the procedure for relaying communications is. But there's no specificity as to what the time period for that to occur is. There's nothing that's prescriptive in terms of how it should be done. It's basically just saying that the registrars should provide this information. But there's no way, because there's nothing that's prescriptive about it, there's very little that compliance could actually do. So, like, it's great that they, you know, that the registrars and ICANN have decided to include something about this specifically, but there's no way to really enforce compliance except to just say, well, have you posted something on your website? Great, you have. You're in compliance.
Elisa, let me ask you something. The way it's written, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, so what I would like us to ask for are some time frames for what the time period is that the registrar must ensure that the, you know, information on who is revealed, and what basically upon request, you know, within whatever it is, 48 or 72 hours, that information is provided, you know, or something along those lines. I'd like to see there be some actual time frames so that compliance can do something about it if it's not occurring.
I have two questions for you, Elisa. You mentioned that they disclose, they don't even disclose how they do it. They only disclose the circumstances under which they would do a relay. So that might indicate that if you provided the right kinds of communications under those circumstances, we would relay. But they don't say how quickly they would relay, and they also don't describe how they'll relay. We assume it's email, but we don't really know. And then on reveal, again, the only thing they're forced to disclose is the circumstances under which they would do a reveal, but not the method of reveal or, as you say, the timing.
Right.
So I wanted to ask you a question about compliance. In the old days, the obligations of a privacy proxy provider to do relay and reveal were baked into one provision of the RAA under which the failure to do an adequate relay and reveal meant that the registrar became liable for activities of a registrar.
Right.
Is that still in force in the new RAA?
I don't know. I would assume so.
Anyone else on the call can weigh in on that and help us to understand. You see, because if the privacy proxy provider ends up having their own incentives to relay reveal, I'm not sure you also need a compliance mechanism based on timing and method. Because if they fail to relay and reveal, the presumption in the previous agreement was they would become liable. Anjali, with your head buried in the new RAA, do they still have the section?
I'm going to have to let me get it open to that specification. I'm not as buried as I should be, to tell you the truth.
Steve, this is Ron Andruff calling in. Sorry, Anjali, just a quick question. The link I posted here in the chat, the link, it goes to rights and responsibilities. I don't think it goes to the proxy spec. Can someone check that link? Because you're talking about 2.5. There is no 2.5 in that link document.
All right. Here's what I'm referring back to. If you click on the comment page, Ron, the very first link, I must have messed that up. I'm sorry. But if you click on the very first one, the public comment page, you'll see if you scroll down, ICANN has provided a link to this spec, the privacy proxy spec.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
There's, oh, yeah.
So this is Elisa. I think it's still the case that if the information were not revealed, that the responsibility would be or the domain would fall to the privacy or proxy provider.
Okay, so Elisa confirmed that it looks... Elisa, do they have a section for that?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I believe it would be the case because they're listed as the registrant, so...
I think it's 3.7.7.3 on page 13, where they say that a registered name holder licensing the use of a name shall accept liability for harm caused unless it discloses the current contact information within 7 days to a party providing them evidence of actionable harm. So I leave on page 13 and 14 of the proposed RAA, they have a 7-day reveal.
I'm sorry, 3.7.7.7?
That's right, page .3.
Oh, .3, okay.
Yeah. So it looks as if they've got a 7-day locked in. Do those of you who have spent time trying to track down somebody, a registrar who was hiding behind a privacy proxy, do you believe that a 7 days is the appropriate time to reveal when you've presented evidence of actionable harm? Take a cue on that.
Well, that's what it says.
Right.
I think that's correct.
Is it adequate? You know, hearing nothing, we'll assume that the 7 days in there, at least is the specification. Interesting that it's not in the specification on privacy and proxy. Instead, it's buried back in their registrar agreement. Should the BC ask that this specification, the two-pager, should we ask that it incorporate the 7-day time performance on 2.45?
I think that's a good idea, because otherwise I think it's very confusing.
There's an interesting line at the very top of this new specification. The very last sentence of the first paragraph says, quote, this specification may not be modified by ICANN or registrar. So this particular specification seems to be locked down. And so I guess ICANN may argue that they didn't want to put specific time and performance metrics in here, since they'd rather have those be back in the registrar accreditation agreement, which is subject to change under that new process. So there may be a risk, Elisa, to sort of importing that 7-day performance spec here, because then if it turns out that's really inadequate, we won't be able to change it. And it could be years before we end up with a new accreditation system for privacy and proxy providers. Any thoughts on that?
Well, why would they be able to, why would, I mean, assuming, what if they get rid of that line? I mean, what keeps them from modifying that specification at the time they modify the agreement?
There's this, that special line that says this specification may not be modified by ICANN or registrar. For those of you who have looked at the RAA, it does have a method of amendment, but that amendment may only be able to be done on the agreement and not necessarily on a specification that has this definitive statement in it, that it may not be modified. Doesn't that statement of may not be modified override ICANN's ability to make unilateral changes?
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, the plan is that this is an interim specification, right? That they're going to be working on this and replace this.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
On the privacy and proxy registrations. So they're supposed to be working on something.
Okay.
So until they...
But it will be a community-wide process to come up with an accreditation, and an accreditation process for privacy proxy. I mean, at least, to be honest, 2 years, right?
Right.
Does anybody think it'll be sooner than 2 years?
Doubt it.
Doubt it. So we found the 7-day number, and so the BC and their draft comments. So, Anjali, I'm hoping that as rapporteur, you'll be able to follow through on this.
I'm writing it all down.
Thank you. Yeah, so part of this recommendation is to bring that 7-day performance spec over into the privacy and proxy specification, and then ask the question, why isn't there a spec for relay, which is two items above it in the list? Why isn't there a similar spec anywhere on how many days a privacy proxy provider has to do the relay? The relay is just taking the email that you sent in and then relaying it to the secret contact information that the privacy proxy provider has.
Okay.
Hey, Chris, can I come in?
Oh, please do, Chris.
On the relay aspect, at a practical level, I'm wondering whether we can ask that the relay provider confirm within 7 days that they have relayed, because I've got a couple of examples where you ask for information to be relayed and you don't know whether it's disappeared into a black hole, whether the registrant actually got it or what happened. the things I've dealt with is copyright infringement. You know, photographs and text has been copied from the website. And I rather feel that if you did get some message back, you'd have a bit more information about what was happening.
So everyone understand, Chris Chaplow is suggesting that you've provided evidence of actionable harm to the privacy proxy provider, and if they fail to relay and reveal 7 days later, they start to take on the obligation. So in day one, a responsible privacy proxy provider will probably relay your email to the secret contact info. What Chris is saying is that the BC should ask ICANN to require that the privacy proxy provider provide an acknowledgement to the person providing the complaint. And the acknowledgement would say, we have relayed your information to the protected registrar. Is that about right, Chris?
That's correct, Steve, yeah.
I agree with that.
Acknowledgement and confirm. Okay, Anjali, take note of that, because it probably would be the method with respect to 2.43, the method. And I see Ron Andrew in the queue.
Thank you, Steve.
Go ahead, Ron.
Thank you, Steve. It's Ron. So for those of us on this call who aren't quite familiar with what this replacement element's going to be, so if I understand you correctly, this privacy proxy specification has to still be fleshed out. And is that going to be part of a PDP? And if so, then, or if it's going to be some other element, I'd be interested to know what that is. But then the second question is, why would we not have a placeholder in the agreement that would actually say this is where we will insert this particular redefined element when it is finally comes out of the oven as fully baked cake? Because at this stage of the game, I'm confused. We're talking about something that's going to be replaced, but it's vague. Can you clarify that for me, please? Thank you.
Ron, the process by which an accreditation procedure will be developed has not been defined, but you can bet that it will involve a PDP-like element. But when it comes up with an accreditation process, then providers for privacy and proxy would become accredited, and that would replace the specification. I don't believe they would fill in gaps on this little two-page spec. I believe it disappears. The program, which is referenced in 3.14 of the agreement, so we can go back to that. If somebody has, if you have it up in your link, open up the actual RAA and go to 3.14. Let me quickly pull that up.
I think one important date to keep in mind is the date that they put in the specification of privacy and proxy registrations, and they say basically until the earlier of January 1st, 2017, and the date that ICANN establishes a program. So, I mean, this thing could stand for a long time.
It could. And when it falls, it gets eliminated. It disappears from the agreement. And instead, registrars would be required to only use accredited privacy and proxy service providers. So then you have to turn to that separate accreditation program to understand what the rules are for them. That's what 3.14 is basically getting at. I hope that answers your question, Ron.
I'm still swimming in it a little bit, but that brings a little more clarity. Thank you, Steve.
I believe that the bar is raised for us to get our licks in now, because this is the last review, and it contains the line, this specification may not be modified by ICANN or registrar. For the folks on the call, do you believe the BC should challenge that statement and suggest that the specification itself also ought to be subject to the amendment process that's been agreed to? Any thoughts on that?
I'm confused. This is Anjali. I'm confused as to how they are planning to amend that specification. Can you explain that?
The statement in the specification says it may not be modified.
Right.
So it makes an affirmative statement. Ever.
Ever.
Remember
ever.
This? Ever.
That doesn't make any sense to me that you can never modify something. So I would object if that's actually what they're trying to accomplish.
What, are there other members of the BC agree with that? Do we ought to object to that unilateral lockout?
Well, Steve, I think maybe I kind of read it like they cannot sort of unilaterally modify it on their own, which I think we agree with.
Right. I would agree with that.
So I think that might be the intention.
Maybe they need to clarify that. Like, it should say unilaterally or something after that.
In the actual RAA that's posted for comment, if you recall, one of the most controversial parts was the way in which ICANN's board could make a unilateral amendment. So I'm going to read to you what it says on page 27 of the RAA. It says, if the ICANN board determines that an amendment to the agreement, including the specifications referred to, unless such specifications expressly do not permit amendment, they go through a special limited process. So this statement means it may not be amended, even by the special amendment process. They've locked this out.
Well, just before that, though, it says that the terms of the specification can be extended provided that ICANN and the working group mutually agree to extend it. So I think it's just saying that basically neither ICANN nor the registrar on their own can make these any amendments, but the working group and ICANN can agree to extend the term of this specification.
Right. Extending the term only affects the time, doesn't affect the requirements. It doesn't affect the requirements. And what I just read you from Section 6.1 of the agreement is that they have locked this down, and it isn't even subject to the special circumstances of the board amendment.
Okay. I'm sorry. I misread that.
Okay. Because the term alone is not really affecting the elements.
Got it.
So we should question, I think we should definitely challenge why, and we don't agree, that this spec, which is new, should be locked down and be immune from the special amendment process described in Section 6 of the RAA.
Okay. I'll put that in the comments.
Steve, this is Ron. I have my hand up. Just, I wanted to comment on this working group, if I may.
Go ahead, Ron.
Thank you. I'm not sure exactly where it is, but it's been brought up recently that the working group, this famous working group, is in fact a body that's constituted by the registrars, and it will include any others that the registrars deem that they may like to invite to join that working group. So it's not a working group, it's the working group. So be very careful about the terminology. The working group is basically registrars sitting around a table and making a determination without any other members of the community present. And that's a very very dodgy thing to begin with, but talk about a slippery slope. So it's interesting that this is an area that cannot be changed unless the working group decides to change it. And who is the working group? It's none of us.
Ron, nobody can change it.
Came from, but that needs
right,
to be looked into.
All right, but Ron, this document can't even be changed by the working group. All the working group can do is extend the time, but it cannot change the guts of this two-page spec. So you made that point's not accurate, but I love your first point, which is, should the BC comment on the nature of a working group that explicitly excludes members of the community like the BC? Is that a point you'd like us to consider at?
Absolutely. All members of the community, not just BC. Everybody's locked out. Thank you.
All right.
This is Elisa. Let me just, can I get in the queue?
Please. Go ahead, Elisa.
I think you all know that Mark Monitor is a registrar, and I work for Mark Monitor. The only thing I would say is, remember, this is a contract between ICANN and the registrars. So I think we just need to remember, of course, they're going to have to be the ones that are negotiating this contract, the terms of the contract with ICANN. an ICANN is supposed to be working in the public interest. So I'm just putting that out there, that it's obviously, it would be a little odd to have another party negotiating a contract that they're actually not party to.
This is
Ron,
go ahead.
Ron, your hand is still up.
Sorry.
Thank you. I just have to push back, Elisa. The party to the contract is the user. It's the person who buys the domain name.
No,
and the registrar is just passing this part just through. So there's a very important element here that we cannot gloss over and say, sorry, we're not part of that contract. The whole community is part of that contract. There's no question about it. That's what keeps ICANN accountable. Everyone in the community has a right to raise their voice and bring it forward on any issue. And so to have a contract that's done between, you're seeing it as two parties, that's not the way ICANN works. ICANN is not an animal like a corporation, any other standard corporation that contracted parties and non-contracted parties. Unfortunately, we fell into some crazy terminology, but we all are part of this contract. So I can't accept what you just said there.
Okay, well, just to clarify, the only parties that are signing this contract are ICANN and the registrars.
That's fine. Okay. I'll agree that that's the two signatories, but that's not necessarily who's negotiating this contract. Everybody should be involved in this contract because the end user ultimately is the one who we're trying to serve here.
Right, and I'm not saying that the community shouldn't have input. I'm just saying at the end of the day, there's two parties that have to sign this contract and have to abide by this contract.
I'm not arguing that point. I just want to make sure that everybody's voice is heard. Thank you.
Ron, I would encourage you to articulate your concern about the exclusive nature of the working group. If you're able to draft that for us in the next couple of days, we'll add that as a potential concern for our members to approve. How about that?
I'll look into that, Steve. Yep.
Thank you. Anjali?
Yes, I just wanted to weigh in on that. I mean, I have to look more carefully at the agreement to see exactly what the parameters are of the working group. I apologize, I haven't done that at this point. But I would like to investigate if the working group is going to be able to amend this contract and then there won't be further opportunity by the stakeholders to comment. That's a problem. But if it's simply to propose amendments and then everyone can comment on them, that would be more acceptable. So I'm going to look into that unless somebody can answer that for me right now.
All right, but without details, it's premature to do that now. But as a general matter, okay.
Yes.
All right, and Ron will help articulate his rationale for why he believes the working group should not be exclusive. Others may differ, and that's what Elisa's point was. So we'll have to wait until we have some text that we can debate. I have Susan Kawaguchi in the queue.
Sorry I'm late to the call. I was on another call earlier, which went long, and I'm not sure whether there's been a discussion of the actual, you know, elements to this, the privacy and proxy specification, but they've made substantial changes to this since the version that I reviewed at the ICANN meeting in China, and I'm really concerned with this because, so I think Elisa mentioned that we're going to have to live with this for until 2017, and so maybe you can give me, since I have not read all this and followed like you have, Steve. So this is what the working group's going to work on, this specification, or this specification is what a proxy service provider would have to put in place until 2017 when hopefully
it's the latter. It's the latter. There is no ability for anyone to change this two-page spec. All that the working group can do is to extend the time for which the spec remains in effect. If we at ICANN have been unable to create a new privacy proxy accreditation process. So prior to you joining the call, we are very concerned that this particular spec is locked down forever. It is immune from the special amendment process the board has worked out with the registrars in Section 6 of the RAA. nobody can ever change this spec. So we have one bite at this apple, and it may not even be adequate. I think we want to object to the statement that this spec may never be modified by ICANN or registrar.
No, I would agree with that, but I'm not comfortable with what they've outlined here. In the previous specification, there was, at least a little bit of teeth on, how long it would take to relay information or relay a communication. And it looks now that the registrars or the proxy providers will have to provide information on their site on how they will do this, but it doesn't tell them.
No, they don't. There's no requirement in here for the privacy proxy to describe how they do anything. They only have to tell you the circumstances under which they would relay and reveal, but not how they'll do it or how long. Susan, is it possible that they moved the time frame of 7 days, that they moved it out of the spec and moved it into the RAA, where it is subject to special amendments by the board?
Okay.
May have been done for our benefit.
Well, let me read the RAA, then. I'm confess I have not done that. But
it's
really
section
concerned
six.
With this.
Mm-hmm.
I do not think we can live with the proxy situation for the next 4 years, with the hopes that something might change. So I'll put something together and send it your way.
In Beijing, Samantha Eisner was very forthcoming with the BC about areas where negotiations were heading, areas where she thought public comment would be helpful. And Samantha, is it possible for you to do a direct inquiry to her and ask her about why the spec was trimmed down? Did they do it for our benefit? Why is the spec locked down to where it can never be amended by anyone? And those answers will go a long way, because at this point we can't just ask questions of ICANN. This is the final public comment before this agreement gets locked out. So it doesn't do us any good to ask questions. We have to actually demand or request changes at this point. There won't be another bite at the apple.
Okay. No, that's a good idea, and I will do that.
Great. Anjali, I see your hand is still up.
I put it up again. So, Susan, I know you were the point person I needed to speak to. I'm drafting the comments for the RAA and for the BC. And right now what we have on the spec, the privacy proxy specifications and terms, is that there are no specific requirements, just that they state what their process is, but ICANN doesn't require them to follow any specific requirements. So if you have anything there that you think needs to be input to beef up the requirements, let me know. And then also the other comment on this is that there's no amendment process. So those right now are pretty broad comments. So any specificity you can provide, when you send them to Steve, just copy me too.
And add Chris Chaplow's idea that there be a requirement for acknowledgement and confirmation to the complainant,
exactly,
indicating that stuff should be moved.
That's right. I'm sorry, I missed that.
Got it. If there's no further comments, let's move to the next element on the outline. It's who is. So under who is, we have at least three or four subpoints. Samantha Eisner told us in Beijing that if we wanted to retain bulk access to who is, port 43, we had better start screaming about it now, because she claims that was on the way out. Bill Smith of PayPal sent an email to all of you just last week complaining about this as well. But I need somebody who has more experience on this to indicate whether port 43 access is something the BC wants to insist be retained. Take a cue on that. Start with, I think Elisa's hand is up. Anjali, your hand is still up. Do you mean that?
I'm going to take it off.
All right. Go ahead, Elisa.
Yeah, so I think, okay, so there are two things in this contract related to who is. So essentially, this contract says that the registrars will not have to provide bulk access to thick registries. And I personally actually think that's fine because the thick registries have to provide port 43 as a requirement because they are now, for new gTLDs, they are going to have to be the thick registry. So providing requiring the registrar and the registry to both provide thick whois for the same data is duplicative. I don't personally, I work for a registrar. I don't think it's necessary to have the registrar providing the access if the registry is already providing the access. The second thing that's in this agreement that people are talking about is the fact that they're essentially getting rid of this access to bulk whois, which basically we actually have asked around, and the registrar has actually asked around. Every registry is required to sell their whois for $10,000 in bulk, but nobody, well, at least among the registrars, none of them is selling their whois records for $10,000. None of them said that they were selling it. In this contract, they're basically making it much harder for that information to be sold as a requirement, but nobody's purchasing it or using it today. So those are two different things. One is to do with access to port 43, and for those who don't know what port 43 is, it's essentially a method by which you can get access to full contact information. Registries have to provide it as part. New gTLD registries have to provide thick information. And to back up, thick information means all of the information in a whois record. It means the registrant, the technical contact, the admin contact, and all of the contact information, address, email, phone, et cetera. All of that information must be captured now by the registry for new gTLD registries. Today, VeriSign is what you call a thin registry, and they only collect essentially the domain and the name servers, and the registrars collect the rest of the information for .com and .net, which is run by VeriSign. But with new gTLDs, the registries have to collect all of that information.
The registries don't have to collect it, but they have to maintain it. It's still the registrars that collect it.
Registrars collect it, but registrars have to collect it because that's the point of contact with the registrant,
right,
at the registry. But at any rate,
and Lisa, to your point, I pasted into the chat, Lisa, 3.31 of the registrar agreement addresses your point about the .com, .net thin registries. The RAA it requires registrars that are servicing Common Net to still maintain thick whois for those registrations.
Right, but not for the new gTLDs, which
that's
are
right,
all thick registries, and will be providing thick whois, will basically be storing and making available access to thick whois via port 43. I know that's
all right,
very complicated.
No, but I think it makes a compelling argument that we ought not be too concerned with the 43 because of the registry access. Zahid, you're in the queue.
Thanks. Hi. I thought I'd take the opportunity. I know we're talking about, Lisa mentioned verification, and one of the issues I saw in the agreement, and it's been mentioned by others as well, even by law enforcement, was that the verification aspect, the registrars are only supposed to verify either the email address or the telephone number. Now, if you see the requirement that exists for verifying the telephone number, the SMS, and all of that, they're just not going to do it, and they just go and only verify the email address. So basically, F Roman 1 becomes the default because it's either 1, verify the email address, or the phone number. They just won't do the second one. And so one of the things that people were asking for, maybe even in law enforcement, were that maybe we need to sort of bump up this verification process to make sure that they verify both the phone as well as the email, that being one point. And secondly, there should be an ongoing affirmative obligation for registrars to re-verify their data because at the moment they only do it upon actual notice of changes. Thanks. That's it.
This is Bill Smith.
Anjali?
Yes, Alisa, I think I I kind of lost you on your last comment. So is what's the bottom line of how we should comment on that? You don't...
Too soon. Don't know yet. Let's finish the queue and the discussion.
Okay.
On port 43. Is there anyone else who believes the BC should insist on registrars also maintaining port 43, even for thick registries? I don't think we're going to have that one in here because it looks as if port 43 is still active for thin registries. That's a requirement of the RAA. And what about those of you who use port 43? Is it going to be more work for you to sometimes query the registries and sometimes query the registrars? That's just a fact of life because until COM and NET move to thick, there have to be two places to go.
I think, this is Elisa, if I could get in the queue. I think that probably most businesses just use web-based WHOIS lookups. Like they go to a registrar's website and do the lookup.
Correct. Any other comments on this? All right, let's move on to the next bullet here under WHOIS. The next bullet under WHOIS wonders whether the BC should comment in support of or asking for more clarity on the basis to suspend a registration based on willful provision of inaccurate or unreliable WHOIS. It's in the Registrar Accreditation Agreement under 3772. Give you guys a minute to get there.
Yeah,
3772 is on page 13 again. Go ahead, Elisa.
Yeah, just real quickly. I just felt that this could be stronger, that if there was a willful provision of inaccurate data, that it should result in suspension. It shouldn't just be a basis. I thought it should just be stronger, that the name should definitely be suspended if the name has, if there's inaccurate
uh-huh.
or unreliable information.
All right, so let me ask those of the lawyers on this call. When it says that it's a material breach, I pasted in the actual text, 3772. It's in the chat. It says that willful provision is a material breach and be a basis for suspension or cancellation. Does the words material breach and basis for suspension compel them to suspend or just give them an excuse to suspend? I think Elisa's point is a basis to suspend does not create the obligation to suspend. Is that right, Elisa?
Right.
Steve, this is Bill Smith.
Thanks, Bill. Go ahead.
Yeah. While not a lawyer, this does not. I don't believe this compels them, and I believe virtually every registrar will use a couple of things to avoid doing that. One is the fact that they are not compelled, and the second thing is there's no definition of willful. And those that are most egregious with respect to criminal activity will never use this. So we aren't going to address the real issues here. And I believe that's true of the general agreement on WHOIS, verification, validation, whatever, all this information, they get 15 days to do it.
All right, we're going to cover that one next. We're going to cover that one next. So Bill makes a great point that there's no definition of willful, and unless somebody else has the wisdom, the BC will say that a basis to suspend is permissive, but it does not require the suspension, and that the BC would respectfully ask that they change this to be as to require suspension. You can signify by check marks or a comment on this at this point. Okay, so Anjali, you got it? So this one will be require suspend. And Bill Smith, were you on the line when we discussed port 43?
I came on in the middle of that.
Well, you were one of the people who was very concerned about that, but the Registrar Accreditation Agreement still requires port 43 for any thin registry. And, of course, all the thick registries have to maintain port 43. So unless you have some compelling reason to keep that, we are not going to make that complaint.
No, I don't believe there is. I have other issues with the who is data, the format, and other things. But
okay. All right, folks, so we are going to go with the – thank you, Bill. We are going to go with number two there to require as opposed to as basis for. Moving right along. The next one, and Bill Smith, I'll put you in the queue, I know, because you have concern about the 15-day. What we're discussing here is the fact that in 15 days, if they can't validate a brand-new registrant's data, question is, what happens next? Should the registrations be suspended during the period of so-called manual validation, because that first 15 days, validations are done by email or, I believe, phone call. So, Elisa, I know you articulated this in an earlier email. Would you give us the rundown on what you think the BC's comment ought to be on this point?
So the way it's written to me is a very slippery slope, and I read it like, well, while you're doing, you can continually sort of manually try to validate the information. During that sort of manual validation, well, you can just not suspend the name because of the way it's worded and basically because of where a comma is located. It reads to me like essentially you can just keep trying to manually validate it but not do anything. And so I propose that while this manual validation is going on, and what that manual validation is like, I don't even know. Of course, that's not defined or described anywhere really. That the name should be suspended. They also give the option of suspension or being placed on hold, which doesn't do you any good. It's really, the name should really be suspended, meaning the name should no longer resolve. That's what I would think.
Steve, this is Bill.
Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I mean, I would be in favor of a provision that, or making it that they must contact either, you know, whether it's through the email or phone or both, prior, you know, on a new registration prior to delegating the name into the DNS. And to the complaints from the community that that's just infeasible, I just registered a name, and I received probably four or five phone calls from the registrar attempting to sell me extra services. So they're able to contact me very quickly for things they want to do. It's obvious they don't want to do this. And you know, I'm a brand new customer of the registrar in question. I won't name them. But
not us. No,
it was not you. But they were able to. No, I did this as an individual, and you know, they can reach out and touch someone very quickly if they choose to. And the 15 days is an insane requirement. It's, in my opinion, if this is going to be effective, the verification process, they need to do it at the time that change is made, and or when a new name is registered. Otherwise, they might as well rip out all this language, in my opinion. It just adds bulk and does nothing.
Got it.
Yeah, I'm just going to go back to my earlier point, and maybe it would have been more appropriate at this stage. But my question is, we're talking about sort of, you know, whether it be suspended within the 15 days. If it's not validated, I understand that. But what is the definition of validating and verification here? It's either that you send an email and you're supposed to get an affirmative response, or you call them up by telephone. And as I said earlier, they're not going to call by telephone, even though they can, as Bill just described it. What they'll do to comply with this requirement is just simply send an email. And so my question really is that sufficient for us as users? Do we feel comfortable that the only verification that registrars will do or they have to do is just send an email and wait for a response? Is that bar sufficient for us?
Speaking for myself, in the internet era, the last thing I want is a phone call. So I would think that we wouldn't want to require the phone call, and that's just my personal opinion.
I'm there as well. I think I think having multiple points of multiple ways to contact should be required.
Meaning you have to do them all?
Do both. You need an email, get an affirmative response, and you need to get an affirmative response on the phone. Otherwise, the contact information is useless.
So let's look for, so that Bill and Zahid feel that we ought to require both. Anyone else feel the same way? See some hands up or check marks, whatever you want to do. I have a check mark from Rod Andrew.
This is Susan. I can't seem to get back into Adobe, but yes, I believe we should require both.
Okay. So we have five BC members or feel strongly about both. So, Anjali, put that into the draft, please.
And, Steve, I think, you know, want some of the arguments. As an example, I'll use Facebook as an example, right?
There you go.
Facebook registers a number of names, right? They're a customer of some registrar. If there is a registration coming in from Facebook and they use the same contact information, I don't think there's any reason that the registrar should have to verify that. It's known to work, potentially. So we don't have to have phones ringing off the hook. We just need to know that these things work. Maybe that's not sufficient, but, you know, the complaints we hear from registrars about how hard this is to do are just mind-boggling to me.
Well, there is
a thing called Know Your Customer.
Yeah. And this is Susan.
If
you don't mind me just interjecting. So the way Facebook uses phone numbers, though, for their own users, you can set up more security on your account. So if I log into Facebook from a device that I haven't logged in from previously, then I immediately get a text to my phone with a code that I use as in addition to my password. So in that way, I mean, these things are being used. You're not getting a phone call where a person's talking to you, but you have to have the availability of the phone and be able to, respond online with that information texted to you. I think that is a decent way of doing things. It verifies the email and the, if you've already verified the email, then verifying the phone isn't that big of a deal. Text them a code and have them enter it.
The BC believes that it's not just the existence of the email and the existence of the phone number, but that a reply be required by both the email and phone. So reply by phone and email. All right, we have at least five or six BC members who feel strongly about it. Nobody against it, so it looks like that one, Anjali, is in the draft. Are there any other comments on the phone and email bill ovation?
Yeah, I think also...
So let's move on. Go ahead.
Before we move on, I think we should also take a vote on Bill's idea about having this validated before the name is delegated, because I think that's an important thing. That's something that law enforcement was asking for, and I think that's an important point, and we should take a quick vote on that.
So, Elisa, in the current scheme, when I register a name, the delegation is active immediately, even though it's pending validation. Is that correct?
Right. So if the name is live, then they've got 15 days to validate it. What Bill was suggesting was, well, the name doesn't actually go live until the validation occurs, which is not what is in the RAA.
All right. What's the argument to say that a registrant can't resolve until they have been validated?
Well, the registrars will say it's too hard. The registrant is coming in from some, you know, unusual place. They can't respond to the, you know, they're doing it while they're on the road. All these, you know, these issues. And I think our response should be, yes, we recognize that. But domain names are abused. And the number of cases where people are not available to respond, I suspect, is relatively small, except in the cases where it's for criminal activity. So basically taking 15 days to verify someone, and attempt to nip criminal activity in the bud, just doesn't do anything.
I'll post this accuracy specification link in the chat window. For those who want to pop up the accuracy specifications, check the chat window. And I see Elisa and Zahid both with hands up. Elisa?
Zahid should go.
Zahid.
Thanks. I mean, just in a sense, repeating what Bill was saying and tying that in, basically a malicious registrant has 15 days to use his domain name, never have any validation done, and then skip over to another domain name and continue to do that. It's even giving you more time than fast flux. So I think that I agree with those both concepts that their verification should be done before the domain goes live.
Go ahead. I would ask if you could draft, you're an expert on the fast flux issue under registration abuse pod. Would you be able to dig up a couple of paragraphs on fast flux and the speed with which you can perpetrate fraud on users of the Internet that way, so that Anjali can fold that in at explaining why we think that it should not resolve until verified? Are there any objections from BC members? Objections to the BC trying to request that they not resolve until verified? Any objections to that? Okay, so that one is in there as well, Anjali. There's only one more point on WHOIS. Let's see if we can get through all this. Under WHOIS, the accuracy requirements in the link that I just put into the chat, that link is only on the registrant data, not on the account holder. So one BC member proposed that the BC require that validation occur not just to the registrant, but also the account holder. So what do the BC members feel about that? Should we ask for both to be verified? One from Elisa. Anyone else feel strongly one way or the other?
Steve, this is Bill Smith. I think it's a good thing. I also have to say that in that section of the agreement, it was extremely difficult for me to understand what was required of registrars in terms of validating the name holder versus the account payer. And
I understand that, Bill, we are past the point of being able to go back at ICANN and say, hey, this isn't clear. Could you answer questions? We only have one last bite at this apple, so we have to tell them what we want them to change, and we have small hope of getting it. But just saying it's unclear isn't really constituting a meaningful comment at this point.
I think it is the most meaningful comment. This document is inscrutable, and I believe we should say that. This is a trap.
To what end? To what end? Asking them to make it scrutable and do over?
To tell ICANN they need to do a better job.
Okay.
This could be with us for decades, this agreement. And I cannot understand how it works.
And Bill, but you do know how ICANN works. And for the BC to file a comment that says, we cannot understand the RAA, so it should not be approved until the document is made more understandable. Do you feel that is a meaningful, powerful comment for the BC to make?
I believe it is. I'm also okay if the BC doesn't make it.
You know what? We all agree with you. It's just not a comment that's going to motivate any action. That's all.
I understand, but at some point we have to tell the emperor he has no clothes.
Okay. Then, Anjali, I would ask you to note in the draft, Anjali, note right up front that the BC raises some serious concerns about the understandability of this document for those who will rely on it, to know that they have a safe place to register names and use the Internet. And if Bill's email... Go ahead.
I think that's a much better way to phrase it, coming from the BC. I'm happy to be more blunt, but I think that's a good way. We have serious concerns with the understandability.
All right.
Like that.
All right. Bill, Elise, and Susan had all indicated a yes on account holder as well. And I only had one final issue on the outline. If you scroll to the next page, Benedetta, we can wrap this up. There's a new document called the Registrant Rights and Responsibilities, and Samantha Eisner told us in Beijing that this document was motivated by something that Trotty wanted, and it was written by the registrars, one page long, and there's one particular right in there, a registrant right, that a number of us have experienced, well, we've experienced having that right violated in the past. So we're wondering whether we need some way of clarifying that ICANN must enforce it. So that right is on the screen in front of you. For those on the phone, I'll quickly read it. It says, you, the registrant, you shall not be subject to false advertising or deceptive practices by your registrar or through any privacy or property services made available by your registrar. This includes deceptive notices, hidden fees, and any practices that are illegal under the consumer protection law of your residence. So they clarify the law. So a registrant would read that and say, hey, that makes sense. I like that as a right. In the RAA, in 3.710, here's the enforcement law. It says that the registrar shall not take any action inconsistent with the corresponding provisions of the agreement or applicable law. The question is, does that mean that any violation of the responsibilities agreement are counted or not? Because 3.7.10 doesn't reference the specification in the second half of the sentence. Those of you who see it on the Adobe, it's a little easier to understand where this concern comes from. Because the obligation says that the registrar has to put on their website a link to the rights and responsibilities specification. And then it goes on to say, and shall not take any action inconsistent with the provisions of the agreement. Do the BC members agree that ought to say any action inconsistent with the corresponding provisions of the rights and responsibilities specification? Should we name it there?
This is Bill Smith. Is the registrant's rights and responsibilities document mentioned from the agreement or not?
We're going to check that real quick. Bill Corwin is agreeing we ought to reference it. So let's say it ought to be referenced directly if it's not already incorporated by reference. What about that as a BC position to get this call wound up? That we want to make sure that ICANN can enforce against failures to honor the rights in the agreement, and specifically this one. And either it has to be incorporated by reference in the agreement, or we should change 3.710 to specifically refer to the RRR. Good.
Chris here.
Chris Chaplow, go ahead.
To be honest, that registrant rights and responsibilities document, you know, it's so weak. It's not really worth anything. You read through that and you say, well, of course, because the actual contract that the registrant has with the registrar is under local law, is not really ICANN has very little remit on it, and the case I've just been involved with underlines that and made me fully realise that. Now, I think I've resolved my particular case, and I think my cynical answer would be, you know, it doesn't really matter either way. That document is just a show document, I think, and let's hope we can build on it in the years to come to make it something that is worth having. Thanks.
This is Bill Smith.
Chris,
I agree.
You agree with that?
Yeah, the rights in here, the only one that has any teeth at all is number 3, I would say. And that's provided by consumer protection laws in most every country on the planet. So we aren't getting anything, right? We're allowed to know the identity of our registrar. Wow, that's amazing. You know, that's right up there with, you know, the UN Declaration on Human Rights in terms of the things I get.
Yeah, I just checked the underlying RAA, and I have to say that the underlying RAA does not, in any other place, require full full compliance with the rights and responsibilities. So I believe that there's probably a typo in 3.710, because 3.710 creates no obligations other than to post the RA, the RRR. It doesn't require an obligation to fulfill those rights. So the only way this has any teeth is if they change 3.710. It says where corresponding provisions of this agreement, this is for you, Anjali, should say the corresponding rights in the RRR. So that at least, you know, to Chris Chaplow's point, that if his right was not honored by a registrar, he not only has action at local law, but he goes to ICANN and says this registrar has violated their agreement because they didn't uphold the right. Yeah, good luck getting ICANN to de-accredit the registrar, but at least you have a contractual basis to make that claim.
Okay.
Lisa, I see you in the queue.
I think she'll... did she leave?
Okay. Okay. We actually made it all the way through. Thanks for indulging the extra 10 minutes. Are there any other comments or EC members who feel we ought to do another call on this?
This is Bill. I have a question on, did we discuss the working group?
Yes, we did. And we are going to complain.
I was on a WTPF call with the U.S. government.
We're going to complain that the exclusivity of the working group is a grave concern for the business constituency. Ron Andruff raised that point and echoed some of the comments I've seen you make, okay?
All right, thanks.
All right. All right, so Anjali, I think you know what you've got to do in terms of trying to work up a draft. Elise and I will do a pass on editing and get it into the hands of our members in the next few days, I hope.
Yes, that's my plan. I'm gonna write this up. Thank you, everyone, for your specific comments. It's helpful to me. I'll write this up, and then I'll give it to you and Elisa, and then you can circulate it. And then if we need another call, we can do that. If everyone just doesn't have that many
Great.
Comments, then you can go with that.
Okay, and Benedetta, thanks, Anjali. And Benedetta, would you be able to get the transcript into Anjali's hands right away, and when you finish compiling the notes, the minutes that you take, circulate those, of course, to everyone.
Yes, of course. I should receive the transcripts probably tomorrow morning, U.S. time.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, and appreciate it. 2 days in a row of business calls. Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you ever so much, Kelly. You can